Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
Welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined on yet another poll release week by Texas Politics Project Research Director Josh Blank.
Thank you. I love poll release week, actually. It's exciting. You know, I mean, it's a lot of work, but it's also like, you know, I think for us, it's just, we do it so much. I actually like just say like, I'm ready to get out there. I want to like talk about it. I want to get into the new data. It's like, let's go.
Yeah. I will not use the metaphor we often use for this because it would expose us to too much ridicule, but I know how you feel. Yeah, definitely. And it's been a, you know, it's an interesting time. So yeah. The polling is fun right now. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot we could cover here. And as usual, we'll milk this one way or another for at least a couple of weeks. And even though I think some of the other topics will probably come up and maybe we'll do a little dealer's choice / foreshadowing towards the end. But
sure.
As we've discussed, we'll focus mostly on election-related items today. We did several trial ballots, but also got some interesting results in some of our more party-focused trend items in the poll that I think we both tell us something about what's going on in the environment right now. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I will say it's funny that when it's sort of like a, you know, the poll comes out and it's like, let's give the people what they want. And we were like, well, you know, trial ballots or data centers. And it wasn't necessarily a totally straightforward choice here, but I think we've, you know, we're going to stick a little bit more down the middle here with the politics right now and kind of, I think, focus on the big picture here, which is clearly the election still.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in the, everybody headlined with trial ballots, of course, not surprisingly, in part because of the results we got, which we'll talk about. But the reliable go-to second story in most of the interest I responded to yesterday was data centers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But interestingly enough, I think, and we'll talk about this more, I think, probably in the next podcast if we don't get it to today, which I don't think we will. But the results on the drill down on the data centers is very interesting. So if you're listening to this and you're a more or less regular listener and you focused on the trial ballots and those top lines, do scroll down in the page. We may have buried it a little bit too much now that I think about it, but there's a lot of competition for lead attention here. But we asked a battery of questions that were more specific about data center impact or expected impact among voters, which are really fascinating.
Yeah, really,
it'll be hard to not
results.
Talk about it a little bit. So, you know, if you go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu and go to the poll, and you know, there's a little jump at the top. If you hit the data centers tag, a lot of very interesting stuff in there that I'm sure we'll write about in more detail. But for now,
yes.
In terms of giving the people what they want.
Yes.
let's start with the U.S. Senate race in Texas, where we found James Tallarico with a 4-point quote-unquote lead over Ken Paxton, right?
Was it 3 points, 42?
I'm sorry, 3 points.
All right, quick. Sorry to sweat immediately.
I've already got it wrong. No, 3 points.
42 to 39, right? So 42% to 39%, 3% so they'd be supporting Libertarian Ted Brown, 1% an unspecified someone else, and 14%, and again, this is still registered voters. We are not forcing people to make a choice. So this is giving us a sense of what the universe looks like in August, right? August 5th to the 13th is when we were in the field. 14% have not thought about enough to have an opinion, or at least that's what they're telling us right now. So undecided completely. You know, some of the stuff that we sort of highlight, I guess, when we're looking at this in particular, I mean, just to say real quick, I mean, on the trend, this has been on the trend line. I mean, we've been keeping track on our website of all the nonpartisan public polling that's been coming out, you know, kind of as quickly, as much as we can, as quickly as we can. And this has been pretty much within what we've seen, which is to say two candidates kind of running around the margin of each other a little bit. You know, it's pretty close looking. And then, so then we're obviously looking under the hood and seeing, well, what's making this number look this way? You know, to foreshadow, you know, the governor's up 5 points in his race. So that's part of the, what's the discontinuity there is the reason we want to kind of understand this a little bit. So overall, you know, something that we've seen has been a key feature in this race. Like Democratic support for Tallarico is, you know, through the roof. 91% say they're voting for him. 0% selected Ken Paxton, which is almost harder to get than 1% in some cases, right? Somebody misses a button or, you know, I mean, like,
yeah.
So that's kind of amazing. Paxton still, you know, is not necessarily peaking in his Republican support just yet, but it's getting there. He's at 79%. Just again, to jump ahead, Abbott's at 86% to give you a sense of kind of where he might be trailing. But I think the key number that, you know, you've sort of honed in on a little bit and I think is important here is there's still 11% of Republicans who just say that, you know, they haven't thought about it enough to have an opinion. And I think, you know, it's a little bit higher than the Democrats are 8%, but that is something that, you know, to keep an eye on. And I mean, I think the thing that, you know, we kind of foreshadowed a little bit last week, and we probably talk a little bit more about this week, is that in some sense, you know, we know that there are more Republican voters in the state than Democratic voters. And we know that in the polling so far, Tallarico has essentially maxed out his Democratic support. And
he was even a little higher than 91 in June.
Yeah, he was. No. And so he's maxed out his Democratic support, which means that, you know, to the extent we're seeing these results, it really is attendant on the share of independent distribution, but also the share of Republicans who are giving their full support to Paxton. So, but the problem with both of those things is those are two things that are going to be hard in some ways for Tallarico to continue to move in his direction. In the case of the Republicans, obviously they're Republicans. They're, you know, generally the question isn't necessarily whether they'll vote for him, but whether they'll turn out for Paxton or not. And that's a big question. And obviously something Republicans are concerned about. On the independent side, it's just important to remember that independents make up a small share of the electorate. They're not as engaged as partisans tend to be, which means, you know, they're not as assured of turning out. And also, even with the results we see, which I haven't mentioned yet, where independents are supporting, you know, Tallarico at almost a 3-to-1 rate here.
A little more than
37-to-11, but still with 43% unengaged with this race yet, which means, one, they can come in any possible number of ways at any possible point in time. But also, here's the other thing to remember just for anyone. So these are hard to mobilize, hard to find. If it does turn out that it's 60-40, let's just say, for example, I'm just making this up just for math, for Tallarico, with the independents, well, that's a net 2 votes out of every 10 cast.
Right.
And so if you think about the cost, the difficulty, the challenge, the uncertainty of, you know, as opposed to going and spending that money mobilizing someone who's voted in 3 Democratic primaries versus someone who you think has a 60% chance of being with you or a 70% chance, but ultimately you're not going to net all those votes as votes for one party or the other. So that becomes a little bit problematic.
Yeah, I talked a lot about that 43%, I think it is, undecided among independents yesterday. And it's not in part just to continue to talk about independents and the vagaries of thinking about independents.
Yeah.
You look at that 43%, and if they're undecided now, I think there is a temptation to say, well, they're going to break this way or that way. But we also have to remember the inherent nature of independence is that if they're undecided now, you know, some share of them are going to stay unengaged, unmobilized, and not be a factor. We just don't know exactly what that is in this environment. And the other thing about that is that I think one of the ways I've been thinking about this is that because things are more competitive, and you don't want to, we'll talk a little bit about, I think I want to talk a little bit about comparing the margin in the Senate race and the margin in all the other races and, you know, what we make of that, because one could make a lot of it. But what I think it does, whatever we make of that, where the independent discussion and the discussion of how much of their own base each candidate has locked up and in which race, because there's a lot more parity in the Hinojosa Abbott race.
Right.
It's self-telling. Is that I think there is an expectation out there among both campaigns, and Democrats kind of always have to think this way, whether they do or not, they should be, and there's a debate. And what I mean, and the point that I'm belaboring but not quite getting to, is that this is a campaign more than usual of increments.
Yeah.
Right? And looking at smaller increments of voters that are going to matter more in an election where the Democratic baseline of, you know, whatever you want to call it, say 9-to-12, 10 among friends if you want, is not operative.
Yeah.
And it's looking like it's more 4-to-6, 5-to-7, something like that, based on what we see in the other ballots. And it does make these discussions of independence and, you know, the sliver of Republicans that are seemingly slow, a little bit slower to vocally back Paxton. Mm-hmm. It makes that discussion a little bit different, because normally if you're a Republican and you're ahead, you're assuming you're going to be ahead by about 10, based on the math you're talking about, you lose. And we talked about this in terms of rural voters last week. You're a little more almost, you know, there's going to be a temptation to be cavalier and to not be penalized about it, about losing a point here or a point there, because your margin's so big.
Yeah.
Republicans don't have that luxury this time. And on the Democratic side, a breakthrough is so tantalizingly close, whether that's, as you were saying the other day, or using the term the other day, whether that's a mirage or not.
Right.
It's certainly out there in the reasoning.
Yeah.
And so I think strategically and tactically, we are seeing more attention to these smaller niches of voters. And of course, the media environment and campaign technology lend itself to being able to chase those a little bit more. Whether that turns out to be the strategy and how you divide your resources in this chasing or not, open question.
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly—
But it's operative, I think.
No, and I think just to play off that, honestly, I think, you know, thinking about it that way and thinking about these numbers and these results and what we've seen from the campaigns recently has reflected a really kind of almost obvious now, and thinking about it, focus on, you know, micro-targeting.
Yeah.
I mean, right? So if you think about it, and we're talking about this on the way in about, so, you know, the Hinojosa focus on like data centers and the flock cameras. I mean, that's like the opposite of, in some ways, a national discussion. We're trying to make this, you know—
Right.
Very
just,
much...
to, just to be clear, just to some context, Texas Bullpen was reporting this morning, and it's kind of out there that the Hinojosa campaign has made a couple of, put up a couple of ads and spent a little ad money. One of them is the AI ad that I think we talked about last time, but the other is looking at flock cameras, and that's a pretty specific kind of focus. You know, you get the logic of what they're trying to tap into, but that's not education or public schools or.
Well, and the flip side is, I think what's also interesting is, you know, we're sitting here kind of shifting from the summer to the fall campaigns. And, you know, we've been talking, you know, for a while, you know, traditionally we expect the Republican to be sort of using, you know, their advantage position to sort of trial ballot some, you know, sort of trial balloon some different ideas and sort of see what the fall campaign is going to look like. And what's been really interesting, given, you know, the nature of the environment that we've been describing repeatedly, the negative sentiment towards, you know, the president, towards the economy, it's been interesting sort of the issue choices that we've seen from the various, you know, statewide officials here in some way. So we've seen, you know, Abbott focusing a lot on data centers, you know, just for example. We've seen Patrick now kind of come out talking about like library school books and a lot of this ongoing attention to, you know, the role of or presence of Islam in Texas broadly. And these all, you know, seem like, and in a lot of cases, setting the data center piece aside, a lot of this does seem like base mobilization. But when you look at the data and you say, maybe, you know, the base needs a little bit of mobilizing here in that environment that we're seeing right now, where Republicans are kind of looking at the national level and they're kind of a little bit, again, a little bit, to be very clear, I chose that word, like a little bit displeased with some of the things that are going on, not on the main, but a little bit. It does seem like you see why Republican elected officials are so focused on some of kind of, you know, just to broadly umbrella it, like more culture war type issues.
Yeah, shoring up the base.
And it's not only that it shows up the base, but from what we know about independent voters too, this is probably a pretty good play for some of these independent voters in some cases who tend to lean conservative on a lot of these kinds of issues like, you know, gender and sports and, you know, what books are in the public libraries and things like that. And so there's a little bit more openness there and it's a little bit more traditional. So it makes more sense to add on to your conversation about really trying to turn the dials on these margins a little bit, because, you know, Republicans in the state are pretty safe within the margins that they know about, right? You know?
Yeah, and what's interesting about that, about this, I think, is that the, in some ways, predictable shift to the issue to try to turn some element of the campaign towards this public, you know, in the public discussion towards issues like trans, you know, policy and transgender people in sport, high school sports, and the kind of issues you talked about. It looks very familiar.
Right.
And it's not, nobody should be surprised that at a time when it's hard, going to be hard for Republicans to talk about the economy.
Yeah, or the record.
That there are, or that there are other things to talk about that are their safe places. But it's interesting to me that right now it's a little bit of a double counting.
Yeah.
In other words, part of it is just business as usual. Mm-hmm. It would be the mobilization strategy in part, even if the election wasn't this close, I think, or the polling, put it this way, the polling wasn't this close. But it does speak to both of those factors now. And separating those things out is interesting. I want to ask you about what you make. It's a little bit along these lines. What you make of the Paxton versus Tallarico partisan choices on the trial ballots compared to the Abbott Hinojosa? Because in some ways it seems a little obvious, but
yeah, I mean,
maybe there's some subtleties there.
Well, I mean, I think the main thing that's just, you know, I guess here,
we haven't really talked about the Abbott Hinojosa numbers. Yeah, Abbott and Hinojosa are doing, you know, mobilizing their own partisans in the mid 80s, about the same.
I've got it right here. I mean, again, Abbott is up 5 points on Hinojosa, 45 to 40. 89% of Democrats say that they're supporting Hinojosa. 86% of Republicans say they're supporting Abbott. And this is
the other way around. Okay.
Yeah. And this is very much within, you know, again, within margin of error. This is very much within what we think of as the historical norms. You know, that's pretty fine. I mean, I think, you know, the way that I'm sort of trying to think about this, and it's sort of I'm almost going to throw this back to you in some ways, which is like, you know, it seems like most of the Republicans, I mean, first and foremost, the Republicans clearly have an advantage. Let's just start there, right? They have an advantage in terms of the number of voters in the electorate. When we look at these polling results among registered voters, except for the Tallarico-Paxton matchup, they have an advantage. Abbott's up 5 on Hinojosa. Patrick is up 7 on Goodwin. Middleton is up 5 on Johnson. Huffines is up 6 on Eckhart. So, like, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty
that 5 to 7 range was what we saw in the last poll.
Right.
And then generic ballots, one of them is a little,
The congressional is a little bit closer. I think it's 4, and then the Texas, I think Texas is 6 or 7. It's in that range. So it's all within this range. So, really, the first thing I'm kind of settling on here is, like, let's just accept that the Tallarico-Paxton matchup is an outlier. That's a different race. And I think it's a different race for two reasons, first of all, and then there's sort of a question that I'll throw back to you to, you know, which is to say, I think, you know, first and foremost, Paxton is, you know, uniquely compromised here, right? That's not, you know, it is, you know, I've said this before, but, you know, just because John Cornyn said it during the primary and the runoff doesn't mean it's not true. Like, I think it is true. You can see it in the numbers. Abbott, you know, polls better with independents. You know, he polls better with most, you know, again, in increments. But he pulls better in a lot of increments with a lot of the key groups in the electorate. And I'll also say, too, Tallarico is a uniquely, you know, we'd say strong candidate from like a political science standpoint. He's raised money. He can get earned media, right? He's obviously got a lot of attention that he's using, and he's got an environment.
And they're executing reasonably well.
You know, I think the thing that's, but what's interesting about this is that, you know, at the end of the day, that's not carrying down to anybody else. So the question to my mind is like, what's the, I mean, sometimes it's sort of weird, but like, what is the top of the ticket race here? You know, in some sense, I mean, like I've hearing a lot of talk, and again, this is just anecdotes, and I want to be really clear that I bracket this and say this is an anecdote, but the idea of concern among Republican consultants that Republican voters will turn out, but not vote in the Senate contest.
Right.
Which in that case, you know, in some sense, if you're saying, well, look, if the real, you know, primary race in some ways is the governor's race, you kind of look at this whole contest a little bit differently, right? I mean, then I think people are looking at, and I think this is important for Democrats to consider too. Like, I mean, I think the Tallarico-Paxton race is its own thing right now. But really, realistically, you know, I think, but if we were just set that aside, we say, okay, Democrats are down about 5. The wind is completely at their backs right now. They've got, you know, I mean, all the job approval numbers for the statewides for all these Republican officials are underwater. But as I said to you in the car, job approvals are not trial ballots. You know, when we look at the trial ballots, the voters are pretty comfortable with Republican leadership. And I guess what I would say is, you know, when we go from registered voters to likely voters, what do we think is going to happen to the nature of these margins?
At the time that it becomes reasonable to think about what a likely voter is.
Yeah, when we get a little bit closer to the actual election, maybe when we get a little bit closer to early voting and we start to tighten up the screen, as we say, and sort of see who's really engaged. Now, Republicans are concerned that their voters are a little bit less engaged and that, you know, maybe that would tighten things. But again, part of the challenge when you really dig into a lot of these results is to say, yeah, but like the thing that I would be like looking at if I were both Republicans and Democrats right now is a couple of things that stand out kind of like really starkly. If I can jump into the subgroups here on both of them, which is, you know, how are we looking among, you know, Hispanics and how are we looking in the different geographies we kind of think about, right? And, you know, while like Tallarico and Hinojosa are leading among Hispanics, this is a good example. Tallarico is up 47-35. Hinojosa is up 43-42. So you want to start right there and talk about what's the difference in these two races. There's a huge, huge difference right there, I think, you know, just to begin with. Additionally, when we look at like the suburbs, which we think of as this huge, you know, one of the main competition points in Texas, Tallarico goes up 45-36. When we look at the Abbott Hinojosa race, it's 40 Abbott, 44 Hinojosa, right? So Abbott's just a lot stronger in a lot of these areas. And if I was really concerned, you know, if I was really thinking about like the Democrats in particular, the thing that's sort of really noticeable is that Abbott is up over Hinojosa 45-43 in the urban parts of the state in this point. And it's been a couple polls in a row now where like that's kind of what it's looking like.
Right.
Which I think is just not on anybody's bingo card, really, for what the Democratic coalition, like, you know, if they think about all the calls we get about when does Texas turn blue, it's like, that's not on the bingo card here. And so I think one piece of this that's interesting is that on the one hand, despite these really negative overall mood features to the election that are, you know, kind of dragging Republicans down a little bit, the other side of it is that some of the coalitional changes that occurred really, remember, just 2 years ago. Not even a full 2 years ago.
In the 2024 presidential election, yeah.
Right. You know, they haven't receded back. And so it's still the case that, you know, while Democrats still have an advantage in urban areas when we look at party ID, when we look at some of these things, it's not as big as it looked a little while ago, right? And when we look at the advantages they tend to have among Hispanics, I can only say 10 because it doesn't always appear in all of the ballots and all the, you know, contexts, it looks a lot more competitive now than it did 5, 6, 7 years ago. And, you know, if Trump was sort of, in some ways, Trump's first election, if anything, was the peak in terms of the gap. But it's, since then, it's actually sort of closed so much. It really does sort of raise a lot of questions about what the path forward is for Democrats if they're not relying on huge margins in the cities. And, you know, not to like beat a dead horse here, but the overwrought idea that demographics is destiny. And once once Hispanics become a larger share of the electorate, they'll just naturally become more competitive. Well, if those margins were
that's
to
become
be what
almost
they,
a straw man.
Well, yeah. I said it was, you know, beating a dead horse, you know, but that cliche is, you know, just sort of, it's kind of falling apart a little bit as the group just becomes competed over, which is to be expected. But that's all to say. I mean, I look at all this and I'm thinking, you know, if I'm Abbott, I'm Patrick, I'm feeling okay with this. You know, I got to shore up the Republicans, which they're doing. And ultimately, you know, in some weird, interesting way, interesting to probably a lot of people, Trump has maybe changed some of the coalitional undercurrents here in ways that are like really meaningful. And if anything, they haven't necessarily benefited the Democrats exactly.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a smattering of de-alignment, realignment discussions that have gone on around this that I think are reasonable to be having at this point. I mean, I think what all of that kind of underlines is, one, a kind of destabilization of these coalitional politics that you're talking about that I think have just not settled.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, in a way, in a very dynamic, kind of strange environment.
Yeah.
I think certainly the Trump factor just, it's like a free radical floating around in there. It just prevents anything from kind of settling very easily or us having a very clear view of it. And it will be interesting to see once the votes are cast and what data we can rely on, which is not much in this count in Texas. And that is the degree to which both those urban numbers, you know, those numbers across the board have to do with the final realization of the more or less the persistence of movement within the Latino vote. And we talked about this a few months ago, I think, but I think it's worth bringing up again this notion that I think there was a period a decade ago and prior to that where when we saw movement and fluctuation in Latino poll numbers and in the measurements of Latino electoral and voting behavior, we were attributing a lot of that movement to measurement error, broadly speaking, or, you know, to error.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the quality of the data on Latinos. And I don't think that was wrong for a long time.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things we have to recognize now is that whatever the degree to which that measurement has gotten better or those estimates have gotten better, we are still seeing a lot of movement that should tell us something not about our measurements, but about the objects of our measurement and Latino political behavior. And in Texas, that's going to destabilize all this stuff.
Yeah. And I think the really good and important point to then follow that up with is to just acknowledge that, you know, 17% of Latinos said, you know, they don't have an opinion about the Senate race yet. And also what we do see more variance in those numbers that respond to current events. So really the Democrat high watermark with Hispanics this year basically came in February, which was the point at which the Iran war had commenced, and essentially, you know, the
immigration numbers, enforcement was in the news.
Yeah, it was in the news. And essentially, you know, so you saw—
And the particulars of immigration enforcement.
The particulars of immigration enforcement. You saw an immediate response, right, among a group that is less, you know, say it a different way than what you said, which is less durably attached to one party or the other. And to your point, I think just to flesh out one more beat, which is, and why would they be? You know, if you think about the fact that the whole notion of this discussion all along has been, you know, and the idea of, you know, once the Latino electorate emerges, once, you know, Hispanics engage in the electorate, participate at similar rates to you know, other groups or whatever the comparison point is, then we're going to see them. But that implies a new engagement with the political process. And what I always, you know, it's funny, like, you know, we teach and you engage with kids and they have sort of, you know, their views of politics and all that kind of stuff. And I always think to myself, when if a kid is coming to the university and like they've just seen politics in the last 5 years, you know, kind of weird, you know, yeah. I mean, over the course of, you know, history, you pick your various periods. It's like, you know, global pandemics and all these other things. And it's a lot, you know, discussions about the veracity of democracy and our institution. I mean, like, that's a lot just in terms of how someone's going to come into this. And I think, you know, just like anybody engaging the process right now, you know, it would be hard to say exactly, well, you know, this is what the Republicans are and this is what the Democrats are. I mean, I'm a professional, and it would be like, well, you know, it'd be a lot of context dependent. It'd be a lot of clauses in that statement, you know, like depends on when and who and how you think about it, and you know, but generally, kind of this, not here, you know. So I think it's a tricky space right now. Yeah. And
I
want
to go back just a little bit to your just comment on your, you know, if I was Abbott or Patrick, I wouldn't be that worried.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's interesting. It's an interesting way of putting oneself in their position, because I think particularly for the governor's race and for the governor's election and consulting team, their pattern over the years has been, I wouldn't say to worry too much, but to be risk averse.
Yeah.
And to be mindful of not being complacent.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a fair characterization of how they do that. And so I think one of the things we may be seeing is that, I don't know if worry is the right word, but they're attentive.
Yeah.
I think they're very attentive to what is going on. And I think we're seeing that. We had this discussion last week about, to summarize it a little too reductively, you know, pandering versus responsiveness.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that the kind of responsiveness we're seeing is interesting and a sign. The frame I'm thinking of it is why I raised the incremental attention piece earlier. I mean, I think if there was not this concern about increments, smaller increments of the electorate, that we would be seeing a less full-throated Abbott response to data centers and the rural areas and you know, the kind of the objections and the pushback emanating from rural areas right now. And so I think it's an interesting way to think about that. And I keep having to remind myself that this is our last summer poll.
Yeah.
Right. There's an interesting, and I'm not even sure that's exactly right.
Yeah.
But I keep trying to situate this data in time.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit tricky in this environment, because I think in some ways, because of the visibility of the Senate campaign and the inherent interest in the dynamics of that particular race.
Right.
Coupled with the fact that it's been kind of a noisy summer because of the data centers thing, basically.
Yeah.
At the state level.
Yeah.
And whatever you make of the data center thing, I mean, I think we're now in the backlash period where people are kind of going, hey, cool your jets on data centers, which I think is fair enough.
Yeah, I think so.
At least in and of itself.
Right.
But there is an interesting context for for defining this data that I think is not so much about the data as it is telling us something about the world we're in right now and what the election environment is like, both nationally, but especially in the state, in which I think we're out of the starting blocks a little bit early.
Yeah.
And that's why situating this, I mean, I want to be, I've been very quick to tell people, look at the number of undecideds. Mm-hmm. We don't push for a reason. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are bear watching.
Right.
And, you know, it's not, it's the oldest of old saws. It's not Labor Day yet.
Yeah.
And we're just beginning to now see the internet the social media and digital advertising ramping up a little bit. We're seeing more streaming ads.
Yeah.
The ad buys are starting, but we'll look back on this, I think, more as the pregame once we start seeing the real onslaught of ads that we are absolutely going to see in September and October.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that I was sort of thinking about where we are right now is, you know, I want to say like, you know, if you look at the top lines, right, and you see this sort of, you know, Abbott's up 5, Tallarico's up 3. It's really easy to sort of feel like with that alone, like we're on a knife's edge, you know, the campaign's about to start. Hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be spent. And, you know, based on the mood, we feel like, you know, the wind's at the Democrats' back. So maybe that's going to tighten up. But then also, and this is kind of the point that I think I want to make here is, you know, but based on the available vote that's out there and where people seem to be maybe overperforming or underperforming, it seems more like it's going to lean the other way once we really start seeing like Abbott really, you know, again, you know, like you said, Abbott's attentive. He has no right not to be attentive. He has such a war chest that if he weren't attentive, not only to his reelection, but honestly, and he's this is also clear in you know the bullpens of to the electoral prospects of his caucus in the House and his state senators. Like he's very attentive to all this, but he has the resources to be, and people expect him to be because he sucks up those resources, right? I mean, so I think that's a big part of this. But I also, you know, I would never dare speak for the governor or lieutenant governor, but I think, you know, when I say like, I don't think that they're worried, I would say like, I think they could look at these numbers overall and probably what they're seeing and they can say, you know, there's a path here. You know, what we're doing, I mean, to your point, what we're doing very attentively, very purposefully, right? And we're doing it with the, you know, again, with the goal of, again, maintaining the coalition, which we know how to do. I mean, to me, like, I think the question I'm getting a lot, just to go back to the data center thing about that is just, you know, sort of the kind of classic question, I guess, at this point, when this sort of thing happens, just like, is this going to be a big issue in the midterms? Is this going to be something like that? It's going to hinge on this. And for me, I'm kind of saying, I don't think so personally. I think it's more of a symbolic thing. The question is, how does it get attached to other sentiment that's floating around out there in the sense that like, you know, people are discontent with the overall economic environment, with, you know, the reliability of core services and just the overall kind of management of state government vis-a-vis these big enterprises relative to, you know, quote unquote, everyday Texans. Well, then maybe there's something there that this could play
right
into.
That's kind of how I've been answering that question. I mean, and thinking about that is that, I mean, look, I mean, at a basic level.
Yeah.
This is now the second poll in a row from June to August.
Yeah.
In which we asked people about data centers. And almost 90% of our respondents have an attitude.
Yeah, that's right.
And look, when we ask people about issues that are, when it's not ripe, we do get a lot of don't knows. I mean, it's not like people are shy about either giving you a neutral response or saying, yeah, I don't know.
You know, I was listening to an interview, I think on KUT yesterday with the Tribune's Paul Kobler, who is sort of there, you know, kind of covering this issue. And he was mentioning how, you know, he just said something to the effect of kind of it was almost a throwaway line, but I liked it. And he was good on the interview, but he basically said, you know, sort of like for better or for worse, people are conflating a lot of different stuff here.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's just like, that's just a statement of fact. And if you're a politician, it's just the reality, you know, right now. And so there are a lot of elements that are going into those ads.
I assume he was talking about the power lines and the data centers.
Power lines and the data centers and sort of some of these other issues and stuff. Yeah, exactly. And it's some of these other issues. And it's sort of like, well, but they are. I mean, that's like, you know, you can infer that that's happening, but actually, no, but in fact, they are. And that's sort of making the soup here.
Well, but what's tricky about that, I would say, and I think I've talked to Paul about this a little bit offline, is yes, empirically, the power line issue and the data center issue are not the same thing.
Right.
Right. They are stimulating some of the same constituencies.
Right.
It's just, you know, rural, older, white, probably. Now with, you know, and this is where the difference starts to come in on the power lines, I would argue probably wealthier.
Landed.
That said, and, you know, we've been going around and around about this a little bit. The data center issue is a very powerful, I think it's got a magnetic effect in a way, to use a terrible metaphor, but on other sentiments that are very important out there, because, you know, you mentioned the way that the Democrats are framing this issue mostly, but some Republicans are too. And certainly some of the people that have complaints about the data centers are, that it is calling attention to a ripe line of attack, which is some slightly amorphous, but not entirely, combination of you're not being, who the Republican coalition is responsive to.
Right.
And a more general kind of class, broadly put. I mean, I think, you know, we're now too quick to go, you know, it's another populist thing. And I'm like, okay.
Well, you don't like that.
Easy. I mean, I have a view of that you know, but there is a little bit of something to that, because it does lend itself to, you know, who's benefiting from this, and, you know, who.
It's probably more fair than a lot of the other times the term is used.
I think that's right. Who's, you know, who's benefiting from these monstrosities, quote unquote, you know, in terms of the opponents of them.
Yeah.
And it's something we'll get into next week, because I do think that our drill down results on the data centers, where we asked about the impact in different areas, does suggest that actually people have a fairly, you know, I would say, I mean, just to quote you,
I'll just say surprise.
Just to quote you said, you know, nuanced AF when we first looked at them in the chat.
Yeah, that's actually what I said. That's correct.
No, I remember what you say, man. And I will say, you are a gentleman in our exchanges. You did say AF.
Yeah, I did.
I'm not abbreviating. You abbreviated on the front end.
It's true.
But it's, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm having to struggle and not just talk about it now, but there's a lot more popular awareness of the trade-offs out there than I think we immediately give people credit for.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, and so we'll talk about that a lot more next week.
You know, can I bring it back to the race real quick?
Just please do.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that really just sort of stuck out for me here, and again, it's another thing that I think is sort of, I'm kind of looking for, I mean, sort of. So we're here, we're at summer, we're on the precipice of Labor Day, all this is, we're going ahead. And I mean, one of the other pieces I think, you know, that you can't help but notice is sort of the party brands.
That's where I hope you were going.
You know, and I think one of the things is, you know, while the Democratic brand is, you know, I would say, not significantly worse from where we see it historically. I mean, just to kind of like, I mean, when I go and look back at the data and the trend of like where we were in some previous election cycles, I mean, it's not...
Because what, in the 60s, right? Favorability, something like that. I mean, among Democrats.
Oh, among Democrats. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not even looking among Democrats right now. But
overall, yeah.
Overall, though, I'm just saying it's look kind of common, you know. But the problem is, again, you know, to the extent that you're thinking like, well, there's all this overwhelming discontent that we've talked about, and you know, essentially most of the elected officials who are all Republican are underwater in one way or another. But the problem in some ways is, and I think this is the challenge for someone like Hinojosa, for Eckhart's and the Vicky Goodwins of the world,
Johnson.
Yeah, where, you know, essentially, you know, you're a Democrat. Right. And right now, you know, first and foremost, you know, majority of Texans have an unfavorable view of the Democratic Party, right? And only a third have a favorable view of the Democratic Party. So if you're thinking about, you know, someone who just is a discontent with what's going on, who shows up, there's an extra hurdle here,
right?
Which is the fact that the party brand as a symbol is not super valuable. So that's just sort of, and I'm not going to go into like.
And it's also not super valuable for Republicans. I mean, it's more valuable for Republicans relative to Democrats, but.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think the way I think about that is like, you know, we could make the comparisons, but the difference is that the status quo is Republican.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, but that matters.
Yeah.
Right? I think those two things.
Yeah, they go together. They go together. And so that's the thing, you know, you might say, well, yeah, people aren't happy with the Republicans either. Yeah, but like, you know, Democrats are minus 18 overall. Republicans are minus 4. I'd rather be minus 4 than minus 18, right?
Right. Well, you're a Republican state.
Right.
And look, the Democrats have been losers.
Right.
In empirical terms. I'm not judging them spiritually, but.
But I mean, when I look at this data, I mean, the real, you know, thing that's kind of noticeable here is that, you know, if you look in the urban areas right now, Democratic Party minus 2, 40 favorable, 42 unfavorable. Republican Party minus 3, 44, 47. I mean, that's not a good place for the Democratic Party to be.
Right.
Suburbs, you know, 31-52, so minus 21. Republicans, 39-50, minus 11. And I say that because, you know, we are seeing, you know, for example, Hinojosa is up 4 points on Abbott in the suburbs. But here's is the part. I mean, this is so now just to pivot this as we get to the fall, and I'm thinking about where the parties sort of stand. One of the questions is going to be is how did the Democrats in Texas navigate this environment? You know, it's going to be a real interesting question to see how much do they try to bring Trump into the campaign? How much do they try to nationalize things? How much do they try to focus on sort of state level management and leadership? And is that effective? Because one of the things that's sort of clear right now is that if I'm the Republican Party, I am going to, you know, basically try to brand all the Democrats as Democrats as part of, you know, if you use Abbott's term recently, you know, the socialists, if you use Trump's term, communists, and kind of follow that up with the...
Which we're seeing.
And follow that up with what we're also seeing, which is efforts to mobilize my base and remind them why they're Republicans and why the state leans that way, you know? And that's sort of... So the question is, how are Democrats going to navigate that is sort of what I'm curious about as we sort of make this shift. I think the Republican plan is starting to kind of clarify a little bit more.
Yeah, well, after, you know, they've sent up enough trial balloons and they're clearly done enough polling that it ought to be solidifying soon. Although you have to be nimble in this environment.
Yeah.
I think that's another piece of this is that it's going to require an amount of nimbleness, I think, to manage this environment because things are going to move around.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of what's in the public discourse, for better or for worse. I mean, Donald Trump's coming for that convention.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of different things going on. I think just a footnote, and I don't know if you saw it, but on the, because we've talked about it a couple times in the podcast, but on the Democratic Socialist, communist name calling slash attempt to brand the Democrats negatively with the leftward leading language, the language that it seems to me that Republicans in Texas are settling on, if you were watching, or at least the Abbott campaign, Greg Abbott's interview on this week on ABC with John Carl on Sunday, he used the term very emphatically, Democrat socialism.
Yeah.
Right. And what's interesting about that to me is that it's a little bit of a blend of the old school Gingrich falling along in what is now the established Republican habit of this linguistic move of never saying Democratic Party, always saying Democrat, on the argument that it falls harder and sounds worse and tests better and yada, yada, yada. Fine. But you meld Democrat socialism and you've gone from that Democratic socialism label that had its own historical rise, small d Democrat, to now making it linking that Democrat Party language and socialism. So it's an interesting move.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I'm parsing something I think is probably fairly obvious, but to me, it really stuck out in terms of what that move is looking like.
Yeah. And I mean,
the Trumpian just calling them commies or whatever.
Well, and again, there's a lot, I mean, I've seen, you know, other data that sort of indicates that in the electorate, you know, communism is much more negatively responded to than socialism. And so that's also part of this too.
Well, yeah, sure.
You know, no, but it's just, but I mean, that's why it's almost interesting in some ways to link it. But I think that's also part of the challenge that Democrats have is the reason that Abbott is doing that is because there are candidates who are still identifying in primaries as Democratic socialists.
Right.
The national media is covering it, you know, pretty aggressively.
I guess that what I'm parsing is you drop the IC,
yeah,
and it's very convenient shorthand.
Yeah, no,
that just
it's great. I
collapses
mean,
it, right? And yeah, the communism thing. I mean, you had a good observation about that weeks ago after the June poll when we talked about the approval numbers for democratic socialism and where that fell. Is that there is a possibility, I think, that, and you raise this, that while the communism label lands right if you're 60 or over, it may not resonate with people under 40 in the way that it does. Like when Donald Trump, when Donald Trump calls everybody communist, in his head, he's going, ooh, I got him.
No, right? Well, you know.
And I think for some younger people, they're going, I don't really even know exactly what he means by that.
I feel like when he says that, it's almost like you're supposed to remember like getting under the desk for the air raids or something,
right.
You know, which is just not, it's just a different era. Right.
The guy was trained by Roy, one of his mentors was Roy Cohn, who was, you know, attendant to the House Un-American Activities Committee. Right. And I mean, when he says communism, I mean, he thinks he's really just landing it. And look, it's landing with some people, but I mean, some people it's like, well, you know, you're going to make an Ike joke next or something?
Well, I mean, to your point, it's probably landing with the people who are already in the column. You know?
So, you know, as we were looking at, you know, you were talking about the issue environment. I mean, I think one place we can end just briefly is that, and how people were responding to, you didn't quite put it this way, but the recent record of Republican governance here, and as they're looking for issues, and I think there's been some appropriate attention paid to the fact that in that same interview on ABC, you know, Abbott was very, you know, direct about saying, we have a multi-component affordability plan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it wasn't that long ago, about a year, I think, maybe a little more, that Donald Trump was saying, I don't even know what affordability is and I don't care.
Right.
Right. That's a pretty big shift. Yeah. And if you look at some of these job approvals on how the state that we had in this poll, on how state leaders in the legislature, so it wasn't Abbott individually, have handled things, you know, on inflation and prices, they were 24 approve, 54 disapprove.
Yep.
Right. But also in terms of data centers, 24, 45, right? And then, of course, marijuana, which is a whole other thing, 22, 46. But on most of the issues, they were underwater.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, I think, you know, look, on some ways, actually, just real quick, this is actually a great place to sit. And we've just put a couple of graphics together. We've had one that we've had for a while, which looks at the share of Texans who say that immigration or border security is the most important property of the state. We've talked about this before. And we've talked about the fact that the share who say that has dropped dramatically. At the same time, we created a new graphic this last week to see what's the share of voters who've said an economic issue is the most important issue facing the state. And we have this, you know, obviously long trend series, I think 75 polls going back, you know, 2008. So we can look at this in a pretty interesting way. But the main point, if you look at both of those graphs side by side, is you can see the clear erosion and, you know, concern about immigration, border security in response to, you know, Donald Trump and Republican leadership, just as it is, and attention to the issue. At the same time, you can see this increase in attention to these economic issues. It's just unmissable. And when you look at this table of, you know, where the legislature has approval and where they don't, the top issues for the legislature, border security, 48-35, immigration, 43-41, crime and public safety, 40-37, then they're underwater from there on.
Yeah, and the threshold of being underwater is the Texas economy.
Is the Texas economy.
At 38-42.
But then you go to the bottom of the list, he said, setting aside marijuana, you know, it's housing, it's data centers, it's inflation and prices, it's healthcare, and then it's political corruption and ethics. So, I mean, you look at that and you say, well, you know, at least healthcare, inflation, pricing, houses, like this is all kind of falling into this. And this is why I think the way that the data centers thing gets, you know, sort of
vectored
is actually kind of important here.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's a good place for us to call it a day.
Yeah, I feel pretty
Anything
good
about else that. You want to add? I mean, you know.
You know, I think one
listeners, go look at this that we didn't talk about.
You know, we already told you to go look at the data center stuff. I think that's definitely worthwhile. You know, I will say there's an interesting item in there on whether or not Texans think we should continue the conflict with Iran until Iran gives up more, whether we should end the conflict now. Spoiler alert, 54% end the conflict now, with a minority saying we should keep going. Majority of Republicans, I believe, said we should keep the conflict going, but it was pretty split. And that's I mean, I'll say, you know, the split of opinion on the Iran stuff among Republicans and the data center stuff is something to sort of keep an eye on, I think, going forward, and especially whether or not Democrats try to keep pushing on those issues.
Yeah, I think Iran has some of the character. It's a good parallel. Iran has some of the characteristics of the data centers in which people have attitudes about the thing itself. But they're also a prism for lots of other concerns that are probably more important in and of themselves, mainly economic, but also governance, corruption, et cetera. With that, Josh, thanks for all the great work in the last week with a lot of competing, you know, things going on.
Yeah, it's
and,
my pleasure.
As always, thanks to our folks here in the studio at the audio studio here at LAITS at the University of Texas at Austin. Most of all, thanks to all of you for listening. If you're listening to this, you've probably seen it, but just in case you haven't, all the poll results, thousands of graphics, a pretty extensive write-up, and lots more at our website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So global thanks to everybody, and we'll be back again next week with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.